Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome you to Tree Fruit Session number 3. I'd like to start out the program, and I'm pleased to announce, to introduce Joe Bagnon. He is employed by the National Resource Conservation Service, USDA, and he's located in Amherst, Massachusetts. His area specialty is pesticide risk modeling, and he does this for all the field offices all over the country. And he told me there's about 3,000 of them, so he doesn't travel to all of them. He says at least he tries not to. But anyway, he also indicated that he does, although they do not do IPM, they do very much interact and try to incorporate into their pesticide risk management many of the IPM principles and so on. And so it sounds like a very interesting talk, and it's entitled IPM Options Evaluation Tool, a New Pesticide Evaluation and Selection Tool for Agriculture. Joe?
How's everybody doing? Still excited? Good. I'm here as a stand-in. I'm a substitute, so I'm excited to be here from that standpoint. I'm here to talk about the Pesticide Risk Mitigation Engine. This tool was originally started primarily from a USDA NRCS Conservation Innovation Grant, and then other funders, Unilever, General Mills, and US EPA Region 5 also contributed to this tool. And the project team is very diverse for the development of the tool, and also national. Chuck and Karen Benbrook from Eastern Oregon, and Chuck Benbrook's been involved for years with IPM activities, especially through the Consumers Union. Paul Jepson, Michael Guzzi, and Kelly Velash from Oregon State University. Paul Jepson's internationally known in pesticide risk evaluation circles. Susan Kegley and Aaron Conlisk from the Pesticide Research Institute in California. Pierre Minois from Environment Canada. We call him the Birdman because he's probably the premier expert on pesticide impacts on birds. Tom Green, Wade Pruszynski, and Amita Batra from the IPM Institute in Madison, Wisconsin. Marty Williams, Mark Teplik from Waterborne Environmental in the Beltway. Scott Martin from the University of Illinois. And Jonathan Kaplan from NRDC, who I think gets credit for the original thought behind trying to develop a comprehensive tool like this that can be used by agriculture to both move away from high-risk products to lower-risk products, but even more importantly, lots of times those high-risk products really need to be used to make the IPM system work. So on a site-specific basis, what kind of mitigation makes sense for some of those higher-risk products? So it's kind of a combination, move to lower risk and also appropriately mitigate some of those very important products that have risk based on site-specific conditions. And I'm only the advisor. I'm not on the project team. So I have to say that because I'm making the presentation, it doesn't mean that NRCS already endorses this tool. We certainly hope to when it's complete, but I'm making the presentation as a stand-in, not as a team member. Specifications of the Prime tool, online and user-friendly. Lots of folks can gain access through a web browser. It's more difficult if you have to download the software and maintain databases on your machine, so this is a web application. They're really working on a comprehensive set of indices using best available science, not just one or two indices, but based on what concerns you have, in this case, for your orchard, which kinds of impacts would be most likely to be a risk, and based on real-life empirical data where possible. Things like probability of kill or an unacceptable level of impact, proportion of the overall breeding season when reproduction is impaired, trying to get it down to the site-specific level on risks that might actually occur in your situation. So there's an exposure component as well as a toxicity component. So we're looking at only mitigating what makes sense to mitigate, something that's actually risky. And then everyone really is focused on aggregation in the end. You want to try to move towards a lower overall risk scenario for your orchard or for your field, and this tool does allow a site-specific aggregation of field-level impacts from that standpoint. And then use pattern adjustment factors is the terminology that they use. It really means, how is the pesticide applied? How is the crop grown? How is the soil managed? How is the residue managed? There's lots of things from a management perspective that reduces the overall risk of a pesticide. So if you just look at its toxicity, you're not really analyzing what the true risk is. You have to look at how it's applied and how those application factors, in many cases, mitigate the exposure and therefore mitigate the risk. And then, because this is such a comprehensive tool and it's taken a lot to develop, they've really focused on a sustainable financial plan to continue the tool on, maintain the data, and maintain access to it, which is really important. Because once you get it developed, you have to be realistic about what it's going to take to maintain something that's this comprehensive. Their starting out page is very attractive. I'm hungry for some of that fruit, and those vegetables look great. It takes you to different parts of the program based on what your interest is. If you just want to look at some individual risk indices for a few pesticides, the use right now, I think their planning is free. But if you want to save data and work on this in a more comprehensive way, I believe the individual user fee is going to be about $25 a year. And then, as a larger corporation gets involved with it, of course, that's all going to be negotiable. The user, though, can go in with a name and a password, so it's their data. They're the only ones that have access to it. It's private. We would start as a user identifying blocks, in this case, in their pilot projects. Apple orchards, grape vineyards, and I think tomato production were the first three that they started with. So these are apple blocks. You start by defining the area. They utilize Google Earth tools so that you can, in a GIS framework, map out the blocks. And then in addition to the orchard itself, are there any nearby sensitive areas? Is there a stream or a pond nearby? Is there a school nearby, wildlife habitat? What kinds of issues might that orchard impact? And as you try to design your mitigation strategies, you'd be focused on those specific sensitive areas that you're trying to protect. After you identify the area, the tool goes in and pulls up the NRCS soils database for that area. So the soils component is characterized automatically. And then you could also, if you have some of those very at the bottom infield mitigation practices like reduced tillage or cover crop or strip cropping or contour farming, those kinds of overarching management techniques that make a difference in risk can be selected as well. So you're trying to characterize the field, its soil type, and it's also going to pull in a climate station and make runs later on. So you're trying to characterize the area in this part of the tool. On the pesticide side of things, the users can search with multiple options, the formulated product, EPA-registered products, or active ingredients. And then many of you already have software or means to have your spray records digital, so they will accommodate that to upload those spray records so that you don't have to enter all that data twice, which would be quite convenient. And then, of course, the use pattern. What application are all these products actually being applied with? Is it a pre-emergent spray? Is it injected? Is it chemicated? Is it an aerial application, granular? All those factors also play into what the exposure potential is and then the final risk. Lots of different ways to use that same information. So what they call a pesticide management scenario would be a user creating and selecting a pesticide on a particular application. They enter the amount applied, the acres treated, the restricted entry interval, when workers would be back in the area, and then you hit the calculate button at the bottom to calculate the risk for that particular product. The output is graphical. Those risk bars in the first section, there's a narrow green and then a broader yellow, and then the widest at the right is red. It's relative risk, but anything in the green probably would not exceed a threshold where you're actually having much of an impact at all. In the yellow, depending on how sensitive that particular site was, there might be some impact. In the red, you're likely having some risk. You're likely having some impact, and therefore mitigation would probably be appropriate and also beneficial. If you mitigated risk in the green zone, it might not be a bad idea, but it might not be very cost effective because the risk wasn't very high in the first place. So you really want to focus on the highest risk and design the mitigation specific to that risk, cause and effect, so to speak. And as you go down there, VOC emission potential is the first indicator. Inhalation, toxicity, human dietary, earthworms, small mammal acute, avian reproduction, and avian acute. There's actually going to be 17 of these indices when they finally get everyone up and running. They're having them all peer-reviewed. White papers are out for review on all of these, I know. And then for many of the others, they'll be pulled in as the information is solid. But in terms of which of these risk indices make sense for that field, again, that's kind of a user decision based on where that field is located and what the impacts might be off-site from that field. So you have to use the information based on what you're trying to protect. But it's a very good tool to tell you which particular species might be most impacted by the choices that you're making. In this case, they selected Loras Band 50W and changed the application rate. So there's the blue and the yellow, or Loras Band at 4 pounds per acre and 2 pounds per acre. And you can see with some of the indices, the rate difference actually doesn't make a difference because the exposure is not that different. In this case, it would be human dietary and inhalation. They both could be exposed at either application rate, so there's not much difference. But as you move down, the small mammal acute, there's a huge difference in application rate because the exposure would be much lower at a lower rate. So it's sensitive to what the risk driver is, in this case exposure, and some of the others, the risk driver is really the toxicity. Even a small amount of exposure is a concern. So both are categorized. This is a risk summary for popular pesticides used in apples in California. I think there's 10 of them there. And in this case, the VOC emission potential for all 10 was relatively low. The next set, which was a little hard to read, inhalation, Loras Band was the one that popped out. That's the one that's way over in the red. And the blue one is glutathione. So they kind of stand out compared to all the other 8 pesticides as relatively high risk for inhalation. As we go down through the indices with the earthworm, carbaryl was a concern. I think that's the highest risk for earthworm. And then glutathione was the blue, which is in the intermediate zone, but it's still a concern. For small mammal acute, the purple is pancozeb. The blue is glutathione. So again, as you choose between products, if some of those endpoints are the concern, then you'll know which particular products have the highest risk to those endpoints, be it earthworms or small mammals. The small mammal acute versus the reproduction, the avian reproductive and the avian acute, gives you the entire risk profile of the alternative products. This is a hypothetical orchard, Green Sleeves Organic Orchard, and their array of products that are used. And in this case, as you go down through the products for the different indices, they're all relatively low risk. As we go down through until we get to the very end, I think, there's some risk, even with the organic orchard. That one's yellow, so that one is must be the superior spray oil at a high rate. Was the risk to the avian reproductive. So there are still some risks even at the organic level, depending on the products that are chosen. This one is an alternative, Honeycrisp Orchard, conventional application, and you see compared to the organic, the risk is much higher for some of the products, as you might expect. In this case, it was the chlorpyrifos, I think, the hatchet, that is that blue bar. And that is for inhalation risk and human dietary. As we move down, the earthworm is the carbaryl impact. Small mammal acute is back to the chlorpyrifos. As you go down, you see the opportunity then to kind of mix and match in terms of alternatives that you're choosing from an efficacy standpoint, from an economic standpoint. How does the corollary from an environmental risk standpoint balance? And in the end, the decision really has to consider all those at the same time. As long as we can internalize the environmental risk into the decision, I think we can move towards lower risk overall systems that can still protect the production system. And I think that's what everyone's goal is. There are different ways to use this information. In a summary way, In this case, Prime can provide users with a risk summary of the number of indices in the low, moderate, and high-risk categories for each product. So if you're looking at it in a broader context, Endofuran had 2 out of 17 indices in the high-risk category, 5 out of 17 in the moderate-risk category, and 9 out of 17 in the low. And then an alternative might have all low-risk for all 17 of the indices. So it would be clear, in this case, if the alternative was efficacious and worked, you might consider that if you had environmental concerns for that particular block. If not, if you knew that the endofuran was critical to maintaining that IPM system, you'd probably take a look at those 2 high-risk indices, see if there are any off-site impacts that might be targeted at those 2 high-risk indices, and if some mitigation might be appropriate. So it's a tool to be used rather than something to exclude pesticides, a tool to be used to decide if you can move to low-risk pesticides, that's great. If you have to maintain some of these higher-risk uses, what mitigation might be appropriate for that particular site? So it's an information tool, not something that can be used to get rid of alternatives, so to speak. Users can also be alerted to indices demonstrating moderate high risk, their pathway of exposure, because these are multiple pathways on many of these indices. And in this case, the aquatic risk was 80% from spray drift and 20% from runoff. So oftentimes we think of aquatic risk just from a runoff standpoint. If you mitigated that well, you'd still have 80% of the exposure from the drift. So it's very important in this particular instance to make sure that the drift was mitigated. And it's important to think about how that pesticide would get to those species, because that's how you design the mitigation. When risk is moderate to high, Prime can suggest mitigation measures, including IPM practices and links to technical resources. This is still a mock-up. We haven't linked completely to these practices, but depending on what the concern is, you start with general IPM, pest identification, scouting, thresholds, and non-chemical methods. More IPM is always good. More focus on prevention and avoidance, more targeted application, more rate that's specific to the pest and the timing of the most efficacious control of that pest, that's always a good thing. Then we can start to get to specific issues like using alternative pesticides that are lower risk for identified species that you're concerned with. We can think about reducing application rates or, not just the rate per acre, but can we get away with banding or perimeter sprays or spot applications? How can we reduce the overall application rate of some of those high-risk pesticides? The other way to go at it is, if that pesticide is still very necessary in the IPM system, how could we reduce runoff? We could start thinking about practices like a riparian forest buffer or contour buffer strips, anything that can help break up some of that overland flow, anything that can help capture pesticide residues and keep them at a lower concentration as they get to some of those resource concerns. On the spray drift side, we have a lot to work with in terms of nozzle selection and spray pressures. We can also put in windbreaks or hedgerows or riparian forest buffers to try to put, a curtain between the field and whatever the sensitive area is. But we'd really want to think about doing that for specific reasons rather than just expecting everyone to do all the mitigation possible all the time, because mitigation is expensive, and we want to make sure the mitigation fits the site and fits the concern. Reducing leaching is a lot harder in terms of focus. Oftentimes, it requires things like increasing the organic matter, building up the soil quality so that that pesticide residue gets broken down before it leaches below the root zone. Another way to look at it is a broader evaluation. In this case, it was Greensleeves Canning Company with 17 growers and 425 applications. And if you start at the bottom in 2007 and look at the risk profile, out of those 300 applications and 200 in 2007, 10 were high risk, 92 were moderate, and 198 were low. As you move to 2008, they eliminated all the high risk applications. And as you move to 2009, even the moderate risk applications were significantly reduced. So you can use this kind of information in an aggregate way to document trends hopefully in the right direction in terms of reducing the overall risk profile without getting specific in terms of did we have any problems. It's not a question of that from a site-specific basis, but are we moving in the right direction? I hope I got you interested in the tool, but to get specific information, I urge you to go to the website, www.ipminstitute.org/prime, and they will be unveiling the tool in the next month or so, the rollout. There's an advisory meeting next month. There will be additional indices added over the next month or two, but it's time in terms of releasing to the community and getting people interested in it and tuned in to the opportunities. It's time. So that's where I would leave it, and hopefully can address any questions that you have if I have a few minutes left. Yes. The plan, it's not all operational yet, is to use an ag drift model for the air side so that you would have an exposure component, and then you would look at inhalation toxicity or toxicity to species that would be impacted near the field. The water side is much more complex than wind PST. What they're working on is utilizing the PRISM model, the EPA PRISM model, which is a continuous simulation environmental fate model that actually simulates all the interactions throughout the entire year. It brings in climate data from a nearby climate station and runs this for about 50 years and looks at the risk profile called the expected environmental concentration over 50 years. So we know things are highly variable depending on the climate, but we look at, are there extremes in this climate? Are there drivers in this climate for certain kinds of water losses, either leaching or runoff? And we'd look at that exposure profile and would relate that to an index based on toxicity to aquatic species, be it fish or invertebrates, whatever the species is that's of concern, and then look at an exceedance probability of meeting that tox profile. So it is much more complex than wind PST. It's not a screening tool. It's more of an environmental fate model that would predict exceeding a certain concentration. That's probably more than you really wanted to know, though. Good. Thanks for the question. Yes?
What's like the process of the non-scientific perception that organic is better for the environment than IPM?
That was the example that they chose. Personally, I obviously don't agree with that. There are some organic products that are just as big a concern, and the goal is to evaluate those products fairly. If they're used at very high application rates and they have specific toxicities to non-target species, that will play out. But the ones that they chose, that didn't play out.
Yeah, the things like, you know, in the East, we'll grow organically, we're spraying 28 to 35 times a year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's bad for the environment, driving through the orchard that many more times. Did they take that into account?
In the water modeling especially, it'll be the number of applications. It'll be a cumulative risk based on all the applications, so that will peak the meter.
But then you're talking about insect-specific insecticides.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. The difficulty there might be the ancillary risk of actually being out in the orchard spraying so many times and the environmental impact of that. I think they're going to be limited, at least initially, to look at it product by product application versus having to apply something 10 times versus only one time. But I think that would really come into the economics as well. And then the energy efficiency and all the other aspects. I don't think there's any bias for organic in the team that I've seen. I think it's a question of pulling in the right information to give organic the fair shake it deserves, give conventional the fair shake it deserves, however it plays out, look at the risk profile differences between the two. And I personally am concerned that lots of times organic is not necessarily focused on some of the risks that are occurring. Just because it's organic, it's expected that it's low risk, and that's not always the case at all. I agree. The way that works is they have statistical methods where they look at historical weather, and then they use that historical weather to develop algorithms to generate future weather. It's not always exactly based on the past. We know that with climate change and whatnot, but a lot of the folks that are in the weather generation business are trying to incorporate some of those climate changes in the way they're generating future weather patterns. We're using modeling a lot in my agency for the future, and we're looking at it from national perspectives. And one of the things that oftentimes happens is the real peaks get kind of brought down when you're trying to project. they're working specifically to trying to bring that back into the data. So it'll be a weather generation, but it'll be based on what we expect to be happening over the next 20, 40, 50 years, better than what we would do if we just modeled what happened over the last 50 years. We're trying to do better. All the peaks. So each year will be very different. Some years there'll be no losses at all. 1 year out of 20, there'll be a catastrophic loss. You know, the variation is in there.
And you, the
peaks in some places are higher than they've ever been before, which is kind of what you'd expect. There's more variability being factored into the future, so that some of the catastrophic losses are worse. Thanks very much for your attention.